to induce Shakuntala to accept the marriage of Maharaj Dushmanta, reminded her that as the daughter of a king, she could select her husband in an open assembly. In the history of the Aryan civilization, there have been many instances in which famous princesses have selected their husbands in open competitions. For example, it was in such a competition that Sita Devi accepted Lord Ramchandra as her husband, and that Draupadi accepted Arjuna. And there are many other instances. So marriage by agreement or by selecting one's own husband in an open competition is allowed. There are 8 kinds of marriage, of which marriage by agreement is called Gandharva marriage. Generally the parents select the husband or the wife or the daughter or son. But Gandharva marriages take place by personal selection. Still, although marriage by personal selection or by agreement took place in the past, we find no such thing as divorce by disagreement. Of course, divorce by disagreement took place among low-class men, but marriage by agreement was found even in the very highest classes, especially in the royal Kshatriya families. Maharaj Dushmanta's acceptance of Shakuntala as his wife was sanctioned by Vedic culture. How the marriage took place is described in the next verse. Om Gana Samirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshura Militanena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutapada Kamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavamsa Shri Rupam Sajajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Sajivam Sadetam Savarutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vishamsa. So probably everybody knows the birth of Shakuntala. Bhishma Vritta Muni was a Kshatriya actually, and he happened to visit the ashram of Valmiki Muni. Valmiki Muni was a sage in the forest, didn't have much, and Vishwamitra came with a big army, and of course he wanted to be breeded and taken care of. So Valmiki Muni had this cow, commandeering cow, wish-fulfilling cow, and from the body of the cow just came all kinds of opulence and servants and dancing girls and feasts and houses for all the soldiers, and they were living very opulently. So Vishwamitra decided he wanted that cow. So he stole it, and he was dragging the cow away, and she was crying to Valmiki Muni to protect her, and he took her back. And then out from the cow came armies, because Vishwamitra attacked with an army. But out from the cow came huge armies, and Vishwamitra was throwing all his weapons, and Valmiki Muni just held up his dunda and zapped all the weapons. So Vishwamitra decided he wanted to become a rishi. And so he started doing tapasya. And his tapasya was very, very great. You know, for a long time, like I said, no one had ever done such tapasya, maybe during the Kasyapa. So Indra who gets very worried when he sees someone doing vipassana, or any sannyasi, or anybody, that he becomes worried that he will lose his position. So he sent this Menaka, beautiful, heavenly apsara. And Vishwamitra at the time was meditating underwater. And she stuck her foot in the water and he saw her ankle and he got agitated. He came out from the water and he married her. And he produced his child, Shakuntala. Then he thought, what am I going to, you know, and because of that lust, he lost all the benefit that he'd attained by all this tapasya that he'd been doing. So he's back to go again. So he just left to start up again. And then Menaka, being a society girl from the heavenly planet, she left a child with the Kanda woman and he raised her. So she was, of course, a very beautiful child and she was raised very nicely. It's not like a normal mother, like in this day and age, abandoning their child, just leaving them in the park or something, but leaving her with Kanda Muni, the great sage, so she would be raised, you know, very nicely. So marriage, there's different kinds of marriages, and for Kshatriyas often this is the case, and if they just have any contact, then the girl will, you know, the man is obliged to marry, and marriage means protection and taking care of her in life. So even now in India there's a lot of arranged marriages amongst cultured people, but there's a lot of what they call love marriages. But these people are not Kshatriyas. The girls are not princesses who were trained their whole life as princesses and know how to choose a guilty man and know how to deal with it. Those kind of women could choose their own husband. And even then they would choose, you know, by competition, the father would arrange some very difficult competitions. Swayambhara, like Krishna, he got a few of his wives like that. He had to fight seven bulls and, you know, different things to, and then a girl would choose. You know, the most powerful man, Lord Ramachandra, could lift up and break the bowl that no one else could even move. And Arjuna, you know, he won that contest for Draupadi. Very difficult, so that, because the father wanted to make sure that the husband that would, you know, get the girl would be very, very powerful. And sometimes there's kidnapping, like Krishna kidnapped from Rukmini. Now that kidnapping is usually condemned nowadays, you know, it's a crime, capital crime, right? But in this case, she wanted to be kidnapped. She was a princess also, and she knew what she wanted. And she didn't like, you know, what her brother had arranged for her to marry Shishupal. So she wrote Krishna a letter and said, please take me away. So he took her away. And then Prabhupada is saying that these marriages would, it would last. There was no question of divorce. There was separation at some point with the Chachi, and the king would give up family life and give up all his political responsibilities and dedicate the end of his life for spiritual advancement. But that's not divorce. The wife is also left in the care of her grown-up sons who were very responsible, so it's much different. An interesting thing is in India with all these love marriages, the love marriages have a high rate of divorce because they're passionate in marriage. They're not based on any kind of, you know, intelligent choice generally. They're just passion or rebellion against their parents. And the parents now have trouble to arrange a marriage because they're living in a city and they don't know anybody. They're not like in the old days when they knew everybody in the village and all the other families. So Prabhupada in our society, in the very beginning, he arranged a few marriages, and I think one of the first ones, like within a few weeks, they wanted a divorce. And then Prabhupada was very distressed. So he said, I will have nothing to do with this from now on. And he said, they can get married. He said, you people are too passionate, you have to choose your own. And when people wanted to get married, he said, they have to understand that they have to take care of themselves and they will suffer. But he wanted, you know, good marriages. He wanted people to be married and responsible and also married and raise children. But Kali Yuga is such a time, so marriage is... it's said to be just an agreement for sex. And that, you know, anyone can see how that's going on. In fact, many people don't even get married now, they just live together. And then they get tired of each other and they move on. Because they just think it's all just a legal, you know, marriage is just a legal thing and divorce is a legal thing, which is a big headache, so they have no money. And that whole mentality of not being, keeping vows, that we find that very prominent in Kali Yuga. And now I think in many marriages they don't even make vows, or they just make up something, you know. And all kinds of things go on, but like even we see people get initiated and then they give it up. And they say, well, you know, I didn't really mean it, and I didn't know what I was doing, and, you know, they pushed me into it. But then if that's the case, don't do it. Don't make promises that you can't keep. Because it's very serious, especially when we enter into spiritual life and we take initiation, we're promising the guru, we're promising the deities, we're promising to the fire, to all the devotees, you know, asking for petals, keep these vows, chanting every day, 16 rounds, and following four regular principles. If one is chanting carefully every day, then the other things aren't very difficult because we stay connected with Krishna and Krishna will always protect the devotee that's seeking protection. Krishna can give us as much as we will take. If we only want to take a little bit from Krishna and we want to do many things by our own strength, our own opulences, then we'll be left on our own and we'll be struggling and sometimes getting something, sometimes getting smashed. And until we finally realize that, you know, it's intelligent to depend on Krishna. It's not weakness. It's a strength to admit that we're not all powerful. You know, that we're not the supreme controllers. Which is why we're here in the material world, because we want to be that. We want to be the proprietor of everything. We come into this material world, you know, because we want to enjoy, and then we want to be the controller. But we can't be the controller, because everything is under the control of Krishna. So these leelas, these pastimes, is, you know, sometimes we don't find exactly Krishna in this one, but then Krishna is there. But it's also social commentary, because in the material world there's society, and in order to have Krishna consciousness, and especially to spread Krishna consciousness, we need an organization. So like Srila Prabhupada made the ISKCON Society, you know, so we can work together to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. And it's working. And then gradually, we need to know what is real society, what is real civilization, and culture, all centered around Krishna, of course. Without Krishna, then no amount of organization
you know, kind of even in the material world, they say that systems and organization, that doesn't necessarily get things done. You know, when people are inspired and the people in the organization are happy and feel inspired, then things get done, even without such great organization. But organization is required to keep it together. Just like ISKCON, people often would say when we're on book distribution, I don't like organized religion. Right? Because of all these so-called organized religions, and they become just an organization, and the spirituality gets lost. That just happens. It happens in mundane organizations also, companies, political parties. They start out very dynamic with a big charismatic leader, and everybody's completely fired up, and then gradually they get more and more organized, and systems, and somebody's in there managing and deciding, you know, who should do what, and they lose their, you know, original essence. So we have to keep that, you know, that goal, understanding that Krishna's a goal, where we want Krishna. And when people are really fired up, and Prabhupada said, when the preaching is strong and the management follows along. But if you have all kinds of expert management, but no preaching spirit, no stress on the individual's spiritual development, you know. So our society is meant for everybody to advance spiritually. And then if everybody's advancing spiritually, automatically we're going to advance materially also, and we're going to attract a lot of people to come in. But we always have to keep in mind that, you know, we're here to advance spiritually, develop our relationship with Krishna. Everybody wants intimate relationship with somebody or something. But we'll never be satisfied. We'll never be satisfied by any kind of profit, adoration, or fame, or any kind of distinction we get in this material world. People are intoxicated by their John Maheshwarya and Shuti and Shubir, by their birth, thinking that I have a wonderful birth. My Gotra is much better than all the other ones. Right? Because I know that, because my mother told me. Even my mother told me that, you know, that I, and I used to get bewildered when I started to be able to think a little bit, because she would show me the family pictures, you know, and talk about what a great family it was. But then she was saying, well, this is my cousin so-and-so, and oh, he was an alcoholic, and this one ran away. I started thinking, what's so great about it? It doesn't sound so great to me, you know. But still I was thinking I'm very great, because she kept telling me. But we have to realize, you know, I'm a spirit soul, like, then everything goes good. The psychologists or New Agers, they talk about positive affirmations, you know, that can help. But so if we're really thinking Krishna consciously, then everything is positive. I'm a spirit soul. What is a spirit soul? He's eternally blissful, knowledgeable, intimately related with Krishna. You know, that's pretty positive, right? You know, we're part of Krishna's family, the best family, intimately, you know, associated with Krishna. We're able to serve Krishna, chant the holy name of Krishna. What a great benediction. You know, I'm chanting the holy name. I will chant every day. That's, you know, what could be more positive? Because chanting means Krishna's appearing. I was just reading some explanation about chanting, and so that you actually can, you know, like there's a question that Pariksit Maharaj asked, that how can the tongue, you know, which is just a gross thing, right? It's really gross. It's huge also, it's, you know, it goes way back. If you're a doctor, you know, the tongue is huge. A big muscle, very strong one. And how can such a gross thing, you know, vibrate transcendental sound? Right? But it doesn't, it said that the tongue actually cannot do it. But Krishna enters into the heart and then he comes out through the tongue. You know, by his mercy when we want to chant the holy name. And somehow or other, we get inspired. So we're not exactly the doer. Krishna is doing everything, but his absolute mercy that we're able to chant. We should be remembering that and thanking Krishna all the time that he lets us chant. You know, it's not some ordinary thing. I saw the New Back to Godhead. There's so much talk now about these japa retreats and how devotees, you know, get really enlivened. And it's important. But we should be trying that, you know, for that mentality all the time. To chant attentively. And why are we chanting? You know, we're chanting in order to get purified, ultimately, you know, to contact Krishna. And contacting Krishna means we'll get purified. Yaparyam chukram kayam abhinam ashnabhiram shudam apapabhiram kabir manishi padibhusayam bhoya togatash chasvatibhya samabhiyaha. The Isha Upanishad is saying that Krishna is he's pure, and he's also two kinds of purity. That he's prophylactic and antiseptic. You know those words? Prophylactic usually refers to some gross thing that they sell in the public bathrooms. But it means protection from disease, protection from contamination. So Krishna will protect you when you can't get contaminated. Krishna cannot be contaminated. He's prophylactic. Nothing can contaminate Krishna. The brahmanas at the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Navadvipa, and he was giving the holy name, the Maha Mantra, to everyone. Fishermen, all kinds of low-class people, anybody. So the brahmanas, who thought it was only the property of the brahmanas to have the mantra, they complained to the Kazi. And they said that this Nimai is invented. It's not Hinduism. This is a new religion. It's made up. Bogus. And if these low-class people chant the name of God, the name will become contaminated. So you have to stop this. So they didn't know what is Krishna. They thought that he could become contaminated. They're very mad, foolish. The holy name cannot become contaminated. Krishna will go anywhere with us. He stays in the heart of everyone. No matter what kind of species we go into, no matter what kind of nonsense we go into, he stays there. He never becomes contaminated. We do. We become bewildered, but Krishna never does. He's still there purely waiting. So he's also antiseptic. Everyone knows that word, right? Septic means poison, dirty. Like we have septic tanks in some places. So antiseptic means that it cures the infection. So we have, in nature, we have neem and things like that that are antiseptic, and they have all kinds of medicine. And you put that on, and when there's some infection, and it kills the germs. So whatever contacts Krishna, no matter how contaminated that thing is, it'll become purified. So when we chant the holy name, no matter how much our mind is polluted, and no matter how much, accumulation of sinful reactions we have, if we keep chanting, it will become purified. The soul is already here, but it's covered over. That covering has to be removed. And Krishna takes that very humble position of being the sweeper, the cleaner in the heart. You know, usually the cleaner is the low class, like a bhangi, right, in India. You have to hire the bhangis to clean the bathroom. Prabhupada would brag in India that he said, these boys and girls, Europeans and Americans, they're from rich families, but they are cleaning the bathroom. They've taken such a humble position, because when we first got devotees in India, they would never do that. No, that's not fine. That's a bhangi. You can't do that. Now they do, like in Chopadi, everybody, including Radhanath Swami, they take their turn cleaning the bathroom. They become advanced. You know, they're not these bodies, binding ourselves up in some kind of false ego and conception of who I am and what I should do and what I shouldn't do. We just want to serve Krishna. So when we're chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare, we're just asking Krishna, you know, please give me service. Should be. That's a humble prayer. And then whatever service Krishna gives, the devotee is very happy to do that. And Krishna doesn't discriminate that one service is better than another service. He does discriminate about the attitude we have when we're doing the service. Is that right? He wants to see humility, that we're doing it for Krishna's pleasure. Yesterday I was reading the Bhagavad Gita and said that, you know, offering everything to Krishna for the pleasure of the Lord, chanting for the pleasure of the Lord, cooking for the pleasure of the Lord. And so when we cook for Krishna, if we're thinking, if someone is totally absorbed, this is for Krishna, they're not thinking at all that they're going to eat or anything. But what happens? We offer to Krishna. He enjoys eating it. He enjoys while we're cooking it also. That's a very important part of the offering, actually. Sometimes devotees think, well, you know, we can just go to the restaurant and I'm a Brahmin, I'll just offer it and then it's okay, right? But actually the preparation is a major part of the offering. The putting it on the altar, that's like a formality kind of. But it's for real because Krishna's there and he eats. But he also has been noting the mentality of the preparation, the preparers, the cooks and the pujaris and if we could even be the farmers and everything, that would be even better. That right from the very beginning, everyone is thinking this is for Krishna. I'm planting the seed for Krishna, I'm watering this for Krishna, I'm, you know, plowing for Krishna, we're harvesting for Krishna, you know, we're bringing it to the temple for Krishna. The more that's thing, the better. So whatever we're doing, this is for Krishna. Idam Krishnaya, Idam Namama, we have a prayer. That means this is for Krishna, it's not for me. But it's not that you don't get anything, you know, that Krishna doesn't. Prabhupada one time he said, it's much better to offer to Krishna. So when you offer to Krishna, then everything is still there after you. But if he said, if you give it to me, then it's all gone. Not the same. But Krishna eats it, but he can eat in different ways. Prabhupada said he can eat just by hearing your prayers. He can eat just by looking at it. He can also eat it and put it back. You know, many different ways. And in the case sometimes of very, very advanced devotees, he eats it and it's all gone. And Pujari comes in and there's nothing left. But that doesn't happen very often. Has it never happened yet? Someday maybe that will happen. It happened to Mother Sachimata and the various devotees. So this Vishwamitra, finally, he tried again, you know. And he got very, very advanced. So again, Indra, you know, wanted to stop him. So he got another society girl. She didn't want to go. She was afraid. She said, he's going to curse me. I don't want to go. Indra said, I'll protect you. I'll go there. I'll bring the spring season with me. And, you know, everything will be so nice. And he'll definitely give in. So he had made a vow that he would never succumb to lust again. So Indra came with this beautiful girl and she started dancing and he got agitated, but then he said, no, you know, I'm not going to let it happen again. But then he got angry. He got angry and he cursed her to become a stone or something. And then because of that anger, again he lost everything. He started over again. And then he did it again. But that time he made it. And then even his anger and his enmity towards Vishwamitra Muni, you know, subsided. He actually became advanced. And then Brahma came and made him a, you know, he didn't get, finally he got what he wanted to be a Brahma Rishi. took some time. But that's the last thing, see what happens. So one has to be careful. Krishna says in the beginning we have to conquer lust. Because from lust comes anger, from lust comes greed, envy, and all these hellish things. And if we're controlled by any of those things, then we cannot really get close to Krishna. We want to become free from that bondage. Prabhupada said that like in the material world they put you in the prison. Lock you up, put handcuffs or something, shackles. But the lusty man, the lusty woman is bound by the shackles of sex desire. Can't move. Has to constantly be dragged down. If we're lusty, we become angry. That anger, is deadly. To become envious or lusty, and if I want something and you have it, then I'll become envious. Right? Then I'll have to hate you. Envy means hate, actually. And the word in Sanskrit is sometimes translated hate, sometimes envy, and in older English also, kind of the same. We hate that person. He's got what I want. And everybody likes him better than me because he has that. So if I can get it, whatever means. There is a different type of envy in the spiritual world, transcendental, where we see that someone's serving Krishna very nicely. So then we think, well, I want to do that. And they're showing me that it can be done, so I'll try to do it. I want to serve Krishna like that also. But we're also happy that person is serving Krishna so nicely because we know that gives pleasure to Krishna. We don't think, I want to stop that person from serving, and I want to convince everybody that actually that person is not a good devotee, he's actually got ill motives, and he actually bribed somebody to get his position, and he's a rascal. No, we want to be happy that, and know that Prabhupada said that's a test of the devotee. When he introduced Rupa Goswami to all the exalted devotees there in Puri, Rupa Goswami was new to the Roshi Chinese Association. But he was obviously so advanced and getting so much mercy and writing such amazing things, and all the devotees were very happy to see that he had received so much mercy from Lord Chaitanya. The gopis were happy to see that Krishna was favoring Srimati Radharani. That's a test. Not envious. Then a non-envious person, Nirmatsananam Shatam, can understand Srimad Bhagavatam. It's for the non-envious. So when we try to serve the devotees, take a humble position, praying that we want to serve, how can we serve Krishna? We can't, we're not very exalted, but we can serve the devotees, and then serving Krishna. So, this is the, and the Bhagavatam is only actually about bhakti, whatever else it seems to be there sometimes. It's really about bhakti, about loving Krishna, and serving Krishna, giving everything to Krishna, depending fully on Krishna. Just like a small child is completely dependent on his parents for everything. That's good. And when we depend on Krishna, then Krishna can empower the person who's completely dependent on him to do what appears to be miraculous things, like Prabhupada did, like Narada Muni does, like so many great devotees do. Because they're fully dependent on Krishna. So then the material energy just becomes a servant of that devotee. There's no impediment anymore. No stumbling blocks. That Krishna just removes everything. So if we continue chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Krishna, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, that comes, because that is a natural condition. I am a spirit soul. I'm an eternal servant of Krishna. The spirit soul is, can't be burned, you can't be drowned, you can't be cut, you can't be smashed, right? No matter, like so many things that are done to destroy material bodies, and then people are afraid of those things happening. Right? Everybody's afraid of death. That's one of the first things Brahma had to create, was the fear of death. Keep people working hard in the material world. And we're afraid. Something might happen to the body, gotta protect it. But the soul, nothing can hurt. So that's very positive. You think about that, meditate on it. How, you know, what a wonderful thing. And eternally blissful and knowledgeable. You know, bliss is inconceivable, actually, but that's our natural condition. We experience like little glimpses of it in good times. And, you know, if we try to really chant and chant space, you know, and we just keep chanting, and Krishna reveals more and more till we become fully aware that I'm not this body. But what am I? You know, just to think I'm not the body, that can be. And then what are you? Nothing. You know. I had experience once in the first yoga and teacher I went to. So the big leader of that society came and he gave a talk, and he was a very powerful yogi. You know, he was one of these guys who had lived in the Himalayas for many years in the cold. And he was talking some kind of meditation, and he actually like brought on some kind of awareness of you're not the body, but it was like void, and I couldn't stand it. I hated it. I was thinking, what am I? What am I? And what is that? I was really freaking out. So I didn't stick with that. Fortunately, in this teacher's ashram, he had lots of pictures of Krishna, so that's when I got attracted to Krishna. I didn't know who Krishna was. And he played the... In America, that, you know, that song, the Hare Krishna mantra, that was number one in England with the beat, you know, the devotees. But it never got released in America for some kind of financial hassles with the record companies or something. But the other side, the Govinda Mani Purushan, that was on the radio all the time. We didn't know what it was, and just said, Govinda Mani, and we'd say, that's George Harrison with the Hare Krishna mantra. What is that? So then the teacher had the record, he played the other side, the Hare Krishna. So he invited Grace and got introduced to Krishna. But, so Krishna comes, you know, when somehow or other he finds us by the mercy of Krishna, when he sees that the soul is really aware that he's suffering and he has nowhere to turn, then somehow Krishna comes. Brahmati Bhumati Kaam Bhagi Vanji Guru Krishna Prasadi for Bhakti Vatari. Then after wandering through many universes and so many different species of life, and by the mercy of Krishna one finds a Guru, and by the mercy of Guru one gets Krishna. So we need both mercy. We can't get one without the other. And whenever we get one, we're grateful to the other for giving it. And then we get more and more. We just have to take from us. Open up. And you used to sing in Sunday school, open up your heart and let the sun shine in. Yeah, that song? Open up your heart and let the sun shine in. So that's a good idea. You have to open up and let Krishna in. Krishna's there, but let us in. Let us be, you know, connect with Krishna. And then try to connect other people with Krishna. They're all suffering because they're connecting with all different varieties of Krishna's external energy, but not Krishna. So they're never happy. Everything just means smashing your head, getting cheated, getting burned. But when we finally connect with Krishna, then everything is wonderful. So we've got that special mercy, and what are we supposed to do with it? Give it to others, huh? I have one question also then. Does anybody know what the word fruitive means? Can anybody say anything?
Something in return?
Yeah, something like that. See, I ask a request now, practically nobody knows. But if you look in the database, 3,424 times the word fruitive is there. Now, it's not in your ordinary dictionary. It's a, you know, in Prabhupada's time it was a common word. but you can figure it out, and you got a good brain, that it means wanting enjoyment. In the unabridged dictionary, it's that wanting to enjoy, seeking enjoyment. So, to be an enjoyer. I remember when I first joined, the devotees say we don't want to be an enjoyer in the material world. Like that would be the worst thing. To be the fruitive workers, so they're working just for their own enjoyment. That's condemned for me. So Krishna says you're entitled to your work, but you're not entitled to the fruits. Not yours. You have to give it to Krishna. But then you can use it. It's not yours. Because whatever you gain, you offer everything to Krishna, and you get it back. And we heard Uttama yesterday gave a nice story about that Tirupati. So many people, they make him the partner, the deity, the partner in their business. And they give a certain percentage of their profit to the deity. So he was saying how one man told him that after a while he thought, okay, I've given enough now, my business is going good and I don't have to give it anymore. And then the business goes down. It happens again and again. But we're not we don't want to make deals with Krishna to make profit in our business and give Krishna some of it. We want to give everything to Krishna, that's much better. I know one of our big lady book distributors used to tell people, Krishna wants you to give everything. And they say, how much should I give for me? But I know you can't do that, so just give as much as you can. She did put it down because she knew how to flatter people. She would approach the man and say, excuse me, but I've been asked to approach the 10 most intelligent looking men that I see today. Oh, really? Why did you choose me? So obvious, you're dressed so nicely and you're walking so aristocratically. And let me have a few of them. But we want to give everything to Krishna. But Krishna wants to give back much more than you can give him. But if we keep even 1%, then we'll never get that Krishna. We just keep getting things. And then they might make us happy for a little while. But when we finally get Krishna, then one feels there's nothing further that we can. Doesn't want anything. But Krishna still doesn't have to give. He must give. Like with Dhruva Maharaj, with Lord Chaitanya, call of HSGR. You have to take something. No, I don't want anything in that. No, you have to. That's Krishna. Still, the devotee just takes time to give it. In giving, you become much happier. When we're giving Krishna, when we go for preaching and we're in the mood of just giving Krishna to people, they want to give us whatever they have. They'll give Krishna the fruits of their labor. And then they give so much mercy. Shrimad Bhagavatam Gita. Shri Shri Radha Vandaneshwara Gita. Shri Shri Guru Gauranga Gita. Soho Bhakta Vrinda Gita.